I'll call the meeting of the State Government Policy, Finance, and Elections Committee to order, today being Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. And with that, we're going to do overviews today of Minnesota IT Services, Minnesota Historical Society, and the Minnesota Legislative Auditor. And so those three will be on deck for us. I appreciate that. And again, this is an overview. Later budgets will come. Later bills will come. There are going to be lots of activity. But we're kicking it off this year by having an opportunity to just get an overview of the agency itself. And with that, I'd like to have Mr. Bill Poirier come forward and make a presentation. He is the Acting Commissioner for Minnesota IT Services. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Poirier, and if you wanted to have any other staff with you, please feel free to have them come up as well.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And for the record, Mr. Poirier, if you just, again, state your name and your title, one of the things they're reminding us all over is that you wait for the chair to recognize you, and when I do, that lets anybody listening to the audio recording know the next voice they hear and their name, because they can't always tell that from the audio recording, and it really matters to our constituency. So with that, Mr. Poirier, please proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Poirier, and I am the Acting State Chief Information Officer and Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services. We have a prepared slide presentation and agency overview for you today. But before launching into that, I want to provide some opening remarks and tell you a little bit about my background and my experience. I was raised in Massachusetts in a family of tradespeople and small business owners. After high school, I enlisted in the United States Air Force, where I began my career in the nuclear missile fields in Montana before earning my degree, gaining my commission, and moving into the technology and cybersecurity field in the early 1990s. In my last military position, I commanded the organization that operated the Air Force's IT enterprise, provided cybersecurity defense, and trained the Air Force forces that supported offensive cyber operations worldwide. During this period, my team also completed a consolidation of core IT services supporting 800,000 customers and the Air Force mission worldwide. After retiring as a colonel from the Air Force, I went into the private sector, where I served as the CIO and chief security officer for a national charter school network, where my team transformed local IT operations across 8 states into a national enterprise IT organization. Early last year, I learned about the challenges facing Minnet, and I was excited about the challenge of helping to lead a state government through the same type of transformation process that I orchestrated in both the military and the private sector. In June of 2018, I took on the role of the Chief Technology Officer for Minnesota IT Services. The last 7 months in the state's Chief Technology Officer role has helped me to understand the complexities of this organization as I serve as the Acting Commissioner until the Governor makes a permanent appointment. That said, Minnet is an agency in constant motion, an agency that is two-thirds the way down the path to centralizing those commodity-type IT services that all large organizations, be them in the private sector, government, or military, are seeking to standardize and optimize. Minnet is also unique in that we provide vertical and horizontal integration of technology services for every executive branch organization to create a statewide ecosystem that supports government service delivery to all Minnesotans. This makes it challenging to understand the role that Minnet plays to maintain the state's enterprise and associated standards versus the role the agencies play in prioritizing and determining the technology needs for their areas. It also makes it challenging to understand how the Minnet organization functions in terms of financing and oversight. My commitment to you as policymakers is that we at Minute will operate with full transparency as it relates to progress made on IT consolidation, the state of our IT systems, and our cyber defense posture, and the gaps that exist in Minute's ability to effectively oversee software development efforts that are dispersed in the agencies across the executive branch. I believe it will be critical this legislative session, with the upcoming release of the OLA special review of the MNLARS rollout, that state leaders work to unpack those findings to identify lessons we can apply to future modernization efforts. Now is the time for purposeful reflection, because the state's portfolio of applications, many of which are 10, 15, 20 years old, they're going to need modernization efforts for many years to come. The IT challenges that we face as a state are not unique to Minnesota or to government, for that matter. Software development projects carry with them inherent risks, and it is more common than not that they face significant challenges in terms of time, budget, and scope. These challenges are only exacerbated by the level of complexity involved in the underlying business processes or the associated statutory and compliance requirements. That does not mean we have to accept that we will have project failures. While adequate oversight will not eliminate problems with projects, it will identify risk areas throughout the life cycle of the project to proactively respond to challenges before we field systems that fail under load and lose the public's trust. I recognize that the troubled rollout of the MNLARS system has cast doubt and concern about Minute's ability to deliver on such large-scale software development efforts. I look forward to working together to identify solutions, be those policy or budget changes, that will increase the odds of success on these projects moving forward. What I hope we can avoid, though, are the types of broad generalizations that impugn the capabilities of over 2,300 state IT professionals. These dedicated Minnesotans and public servants often forego larger salaries in the private sector to support aging state IT systems that Minnesotans rely on every day to support their health and safety. And our ability to recruit and retain the best talent in Minnesota to do that work is more challenging when oversimplified narratives are applied to highly complex challenges. Finally, as it relates to IT consolidation, it's important to note that the commoditizing of shared IT services through consolidation is steeped in data supporting the business case in both government and the private sector. However, because IT is very personal to individuals and organizations, IT consolidation efforts are met with varying degrees of concern. Service levels, responsiveness, and perceived loss of control are common themes to that end. And these concerns have merit. And that is how we complete consolidation. How we do that is as crucial to the success as the end game itself. We have learned many lessons from our efforts thus far, and we are employing those as we continue our efforts in this area. I look forward to working with you during my tenure. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some opening remarks. With your permission, Madam Chair, I will proceed to the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Poirier. Please proceed.
I'm going to click to the next slide here. Who we are. Wherever you look, Minnesota IT services are there. As I mentioned before, we have 2,300 dedicated IT professionals that are located in 90 different locations across greater Minnesota. We partner with other executive branch agencies to further their missions, enable their innovation, and leverage technologies to benefit all Minnesotans. We build and maintain IT systems and services and provide IT and cybersecurity strategy and leadership. In 2018, Minnesota received an A- in the Digital State Survey and earned a top 5 national ranking for exemplary work in emerging technologies, innovation, finance, and administration. We're also very proud of our efforts to increase diversity among our workforce. We have a workforce that is more than 30% women. That is above the national average in the IT arena. We are 23% with racial and ethnic minorities, 8% persons with a disability, and 9% veterans. We do represent Minnesota. As you can see from this slide right here, I mentioned before, we represent, help, and support 90 partner agencies, boards, commissions, and councils, every piece and element of the executive branch. And we do this in 1,300 different locations across greater Minnesota. Our citizens, it allows our citizens to gain access to all those resources and capabilities that our agencies provide and deliver directly to them. We don't deliver the service directly to the citizens. We enable every other agency to that end. And so what is it that we do? We are the cybersecurity provider for the state. We provide the network dial tone for all the state agencies. We provide that front end, tier one, tier two, tier three level customer support to every state agency and employee. Just as the Minnesota Department of Transportation provides the highways for our buses, for our cars on a daily basis, we provide the information superhighway that allows the agencies to connect with their customers, our 5.5 million citizens. We also deliver the web applications and services that are necessary to create that customer experience that our citizens have come to expect. And further, what we do in the cloud and data center area is providing a home that is safe and secure for the data that is consumed not only by our agencies, but by our 5.5 million citizens. Taking a step back and looking at our history, in 2011, legislation was passed that established Minnet, as you all know. And as a consequence of that, it also established the need to consolidate the IT services, capabilities, and personnel under one agency and under the leadership of a state chief information officer. It's staggering when you look at some of the numbers that are associated with what we do in Minnet. 100 million electronic transactions are processed that not only support our stakeholders and the state agencies, but also our 5.5 million citizens. 35,000 state employees. 2,800 agency applications that we support with our 2,300 personnel. And then at any one time, there are 350 major IT projects that are underway and being orchestrated. And this is how we operate. There's very little money that comes directly to Minnet because that money comes in a fee-for-service model. The largest extent of that money is expended providing the local agency IT services in the form of software applications and server support. Centrally, we perform those enterprise IT functions that I discussed earlier in my briefing. And we have a small piece of general and special revenue funds as well. And the other small piece that we have there is the network dial tone that we're providing to our cities, in our schools, in our colleges. As far as our priorities, three big ones. Number one, we need to secure the state. It's no secret that we have had challenges doing that based upon the current state of the agency and the funding levels. The big ask that we have to do, that's not going to get solved in a one-year budget, a two-year budget, or a couple of bienniums. We need a strategic plan, a 10-year plan, that is going to solve the modernization of our state enterprise ecosystem. And when we can do both of those things, we can continue to transform the citizen experience. We're going to create more efficient government by leveraging the economies of scale and the work efforts that we're doing. And we're going to make decisions that are based upon data. We're going to make decisions that are going to be done in a way where it will end up being the best business decision. And that's what smart sourcing is all about. Thank you for allowing me the time to give an overview of Minute. And that's all that I have at this point, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Poirier. Members, do you have questions for Mr. Poirier? Seeing none at this time, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, the next item on the agenda is the Minnesota Historical Society. And we're having the Director of Public Policy, Mr. Kelleher, today to make the presentation.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And for the record, I hope maybe just remembering to state your name and
right.
So on for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members and guests, my name is Kent Whitworth. It is my privilege to serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Joining me today, as you mentioned, is David Kelleher, the MNHS Director of Public Policy. I'd also like to recognize our three deputy directors, Dr. Melanie Adams, who oversees our learning initiatives, Jennifer Jones, who oversees our preservation and outreach, Doug Marty, who oversees our administration team, as well as Fred Neer, who is our CFO, and Ann Oldenkamp, who is our financial planning and analysis manager. Today, what we'd like to do is provide a brief overview, much in the similar format that you just heard. We'd like to talk first about who we are, what we do, how we do it, which we'll touch on some budget issues, and then why history matters. On this first slide, I think that it's significant to point out that the Minnesota Historical Society was chartered by the territorial legislature in 1849, a full 9 years before statehood. And in my view, that speaks volumes about how Minnesotans value history and have for years. Moving to the next slide, when we talk about who we are, it starts with our mission. And in that statement, you see that history is powerful. History is transformative. And this bold mission, which has been in place for years, and also MNHS's relentless, but albeit not perfect, pursuit to fulfill that mission, that's why many people across the country consider this organization the nation's finest state historical society. You might think that a little bold on my part, but let me let you know that I've been here 6 months, so I can't take the credit for the success of my colleagues over the years. But I can tell you, from having admired this organization for afar for some 15 years, that that reputation is widespread and really quite unanimous. And now that I've been in the organization, I see that it is richly earned. History is not simply names and dates. It's a skill. It's actually a set of skills, not unlike STEM. It's evidence-based, yet there's room for interpretation. It's valuable. It's relevant. We'll touch on that as we proceed. Who we are is further defined by our priorities. The Minnesota Historical Society has four strategic priorities. The first is focusing on Minnesota's historical resources. And you see on the slide how we define those resources. The key concept here is access. Our second priority is educational relevance. We explore not just what happened, but why it happened. This is helpful for us to see the connections between the past and present. And frankly, there is a natural and an almost an inevitable tension between the past and the present. But together we can navigate that tension and learn from it. Continuing with who we are, our third priority is inclusion and diversity. I'd like to tell you a quick story shared with me by a chaperone. Last spring, this lady accompanied her daughter's school group to the Minnesota History Center. She had several elementary school age girls in her charge. As they walked by a large banner promoting an upcoming Somali exhibition that actually opened in June, one of the little girls pointed and said, "Look, that's my story." That's what we mean when we say inclusion and diversity. Our fourth and final strategic priority is sustainability and stewardship. Years ago, I had a colleague comment to me that we are in the forever business. Those of us in history need to take the long view, especially when it comes to caring for our collections. But we also need to consistently deliver great visitor experiences. And of course, we need to make sure that we have the financial resources, public, private, and earned, to fulfill our mission over time. Moving on to what. So what does the Minnesota Historical Society do to fulfill our mission? You see that we provide a wide range of programs. Sometimes that takes place at historic sites, also museums that include the History Center in Mill City. Exhibitions are a huge part of our work. And I hope that many of you have done research in our library and have been inspired by the depth of our collections. We manage the state archives. We provide technical assistance and grants to local organizations across the state through our heritage preservation initiatives. And the MNHS Press is prolific. I hope you've had an opportunity to enjoy some of those publications. But what we do is tied to what we have in our collections. Maybe another way to say that is our collections are the fuel that powers most everything we do at MNHS. And as you see from these statistics on the screen and on your hard copy, the Minnesota Historical Society collection is sizable, but it's also significant. Significant at a national and really, I think, at an international level. Presenting our statewide network of historic sites, and we have 26 open to the public and several more that we hold for preservation purposes. Presenting that statewide historic site network is core to what we do. Over the first 6 months I've been here, I've had the privilege to visit 23 of our sites. Look forward to getting to the last few. One of the most exciting aspects of working at the Minnesota Historical Society and in Minnesota history is that people engage with what we do. These numbers speak for themselves. I'm proud to report that for the second consecutive year, we have had more than 1 million visitors, 1.1 million visitors this last year. Speaking of numbers, if you were going to look at one page or one slide, I would encourage you to take a look at this one. In fact, I hope you've got a copy of our 2018 annual report. If you thumb past the first two pages, and you should see that infographic on the left of the annual report. This quantifies the impact of the Minnesota Historical Society from July 2017 through June of 2018. Those numbers help explain the reputation and the position in our field that the Minnesota Historical Society enjoys. MNHS also publishes Minnesota's history textbook, which is used by more than 80% of Minnesota's sixth graders. It's called Northern Lights. Needless to say, this textbook and the accompanying electronic materials are core to what we do. And we have several copies for you to peruse at your convenience. Our volunteers and interns are a huge part of what we do and, frankly, how we do it. You see on this screen, we've got more than 2,500 volunteers and interns. And in recent years, they have provided anywhere from 50 to more than 70,000 years of service. This past year, we reached a remarkable milestone in our intern and volunteer program when we passed the 1 million hours mark in service since 1994. To say the volunteer and intern program is an anchor to how we do what we do would be an understatement. And now it's my pleasure to ask David Kelleher to say a little bit more about how we do what we do. But before I hand off to David, on behalf of our 2,600 volunteers, on behalf of my colleagues and the governing board of the Minnesota Historical Society, and our more than 24,000 members, please accept our heartfelt thanks for partnering with the Minnesota Historical Society all these years. We are deeply grateful. David?
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. Before you just moved on, I want to mention there's one little thing on your statistics, is that you have the original land survey records of the state of Minnesota.
Right. And I know that that's near and dear to your heart in particular.
And we worked with Minnesota Historical Society and those interns in order to do a lot of that work. It was a very unique story. Maybe someday the story of that project, because it is quite unique, might be included in some of your stories that you tell. With that, Mr. Kelleher, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, I'm David Kelleher, Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you, Madam Chair. While I realize this is not a budget hearing, we thought it would be helpful to give you a quick snapshot of the funding picture that we have. And as I look at the slide, I see that there's a little glitch that doesn't describe the blue piece of pie, which is showing in your printed handout, is the general fund. And that general fund appropriation of approximately $23 million each year really provides a foundation for all the work that we do. 40% of that general fund appropriation goes to staffing, and a bulk of the rest of it goes to facilities, taking care of those historic sites and museums that we operate for the public. But we don't rest on just the general fund appropriation that you and the people of Minnesota provide. We have earned revenue. We have a very successful development office. We have 24,000 members who are very generous in helping us to deliver a better history product to more people across the state, and we appreciate all these different sources of funds that we are able to use. On the expenditure side, and again, the PowerPoint lost something in the translation up on the screen, so that's not very helpful, but I can tell you it's showing up on your printed edition, and a large majority of those dollars go to historic sites and museums. 40% go to historic sites and museums, library, management in general, education, and historic preservation. We have 458 full-time equivalents who carry out this work. Many of our staff are seasonal or part-time, helping out at those historic sites during the summer season when they operate. So we hope to have a chance to come back and present some more budget information. And Madam Chair, we really also hope that you and the committee, or as individuals, are able to come over to the History Center, do a behind-the-scenes tour, and we can show everyone else the documents that you're talking about that were held for 150 years by the Secretary of State and are now in the good care over at the History Center. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We thank you for your leadership
you,
in that transition. So I would like to close with why we feel history matters so much. It matters for several reasons. It matters because we are the conduit between the past and the future. We have a responsibility to preserve and to share our history, and then to make sure that it's in a position to pass along to the next generation. By Minnesota state statute, Minnesotans rely on MNHS to preserve and provide access to the evidence, and you've seen the scale of that evidence that we hold in our collections. But we also, by statute, have an educational responsibility to provide opportunities for people to learn from history, learn both skills and content. And finally, there is an economic reason why history matters so much, and that's because it is an important component to Minnesota's tourism economy. As I have traveled across the state in my first 6 months on the job, we've asked Minnesotans why their history matters. The responses have been inspiring and insightful. I love this image and the wisdom of this Minnesota veteran. He wrote, "History is a window to the past and the future. Open it." I'm particularly inspired by his call to action, to open it. To this veteran's point, history has more to do with the future than it does the past. And I am very encouraged by the future, especially as I think about the 25,000 middle school and high school students involved in National History Day. Simply put, they are amazing. This image is of the Minnesota delegation that competed at the national, which is really an international contest that took place in the late spring, early summer of 2018. Minnesota had a banner year. Four projects, which were produced by and presented by students from Minneapolis to Duluth, four projects were selected as national champions. No other state has ever accomplished that feat in a single year. So here is one of our national champions with her teacher. I close by saying Minnesota's future is bright because our youth know that history matters. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. And I've had the privilege of, in my district, and being part of the History Day, as they have asked a variety of us as legislators to participate in that work, which has always been very, very, very encouraging to be a part of that. Appreciate that very much. One of the things, maybe Mr. Kelleher, I know you gave us the general fund, but I would hope either in a future presentation or otherwise that we get a sense of the total funds and their sources as well that the History Center relies upon. It would be very helpful to kind of know that. Members, any questions at this time? Senator Lane?
Yes, I very much enjoyed looking at the book. Is it geared to fourth graders?
Sixth graders.
Sixth graders?
Uh-huh.
And is the book available?
Yes, it certainly is.
Okay, great.
We've also created a number of electronic resources that complement the printed textbook.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth.
Thank you.
Members, with that, we'll continue to take a look at that book, and we'll hear more from you again. But this time, no questions. We'll just go on. And thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher and Mr. Whitworth. And our next one that we have in our agenda today is the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Well, welcome, Mr. Nobles. Glad to have you with us here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor. With me at the table is Judy Randall, Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Program Evaluation Division, and Chris Boozy, Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. Madam Chair and members, you're a challenging group to be before because you already know a lot about us. And yet, we really appreciate this opportunity to really remind you of some things that are important to you and important to us. And let me just start with the mission. And you've heard others talk about their mission. And, you know, sometimes people put the plaque on the wall with their mission statement. And that's nice. But I can genuinely say to you that our mission is really what drives us every day, because we know why we're here. We know why you created us back in 1973. I said to some House members this morning, and I looked around, and it was a group of a lot of new members, and I said, you know, some of you weren't here when your colleagues in 1973 created the Office of Legislative Auditor. Some of you may have been. You have some senior members. But I was here, and so I had the great privilege of understanding why the legislature was creating this office. And it was really to extend the arm of legislative oversight and accountability. You do a lot of that work in these committees, but there are some things that we can do for you. For example, we do this work 12 months a year, every day. We also have some authority to do the work that may enhance a legislative oversight. But that is really what drives us, because I know and we know that's why we were created back some decades ago. We also, along the way, would like to be able to point out where state government can do better, point to problems, and make recommendations for improvements. So those are the things that we really care about. One of the reminders I want to give you is just the breadth of our jurisdiction. Again, this is the jurisdiction that you created in the law. And frankly, over the years, since 1973, it's expanded quite a bit. But it is up to you to say who we have authority and jurisdiction to audit. So it's everything in the executive branch, from the governor down to any board or commission. It's the judicial branch, and I think sometimes people don't realize that we actually have jurisdiction to audit in the judicial branch. We have jurisdiction in higher education, the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. We don't do a lot of work there because they have very strong internal audit organizations and offices. But when called upon, we have that jurisdiction. And then we have responsibility and jurisdiction over the metropolitan agencies. Just last year, the legislature expanded that. And we don't do a great deal of work, but we have been doing work, as you know, in the area of metropolitan transit. And the jurisdiction is there. Whenever you have issues, we have the authority to go in and audit. Another important aspect of our jurisdiction are the nonprofit organizations. And you just heard from one of the premier ones, the Minnesota Historical Society. And we do audit the Historical Society from time to time. But any nonprofit organization that receives money from the state of Minnesota, and there are many, we have jurisdiction and authority to audit. And then we can just basically track state money, whether it's in a contract with a private company or wherever that public money has gone. So that's jurisdiction, but to emphasize a little more on authority, one of the things that you have given us in the law is the authority to see all documents and data regardless of classifications. And I'm sure you know there are times when you want to know things about what's going on in state government, and you will be told, we can't tell you because it's classified as not public. We have the jurisdiction, the authority to see all of those documents and data, regardless of classification. That's what you've put as our authority in the law. Now, you have also said we are subject to the Government Data Practices Act, so when we see and review private, confidential, not public information, we cannot come here and disclose it. But it will be important for us to see that information to formulate our findings and our conclusions. And we do that a lot. And I think it's a very important part of our authority. We also have authority to issue subpoenas. And I know I created a little bit of a flurry recently by doing that. We don't do that very often because you've given state agencies the responsibility and others who receive public money to cooperate with us. And so we use that subpoena authority as kind of a last resort. I think, as I mentioned to the media, this is the first time in 35 years as I've been legislative auditor that I issued a subpoena to a state agency. So it's very rare, but if it's necessary, I will do it. Another important authority that you've given us is the ability to protect sources, and that is extremely important. Many people that we need to talk to, sometimes people inside government or outside government, are reluctant to come forth for a variety of reasons. They may be a whistleblower, and they're concerned about being protected. And so we have the authority to classify their identity as we get that information from them. So turning to who do we report to? Well, we report to all of you, but most particularly to the Legislative Audit Commission. And we have with us today the current chair and a former chair, Senator Kiffmeyer being the current chair of the Legislative Audit Commission and Senator Rest, having been chair more times than I can count. But it really is important that you have created an oversight group for us that has great credibility because it's bipartisan, it's bicameral. But I think even more important, they are people who really understand the function of the Legislative Auditor's Office. And they support that work. They understand who we are, what we do. And over the years, that has really been a foundation stone for us, that we have that group of legislators who not only support us, that's important, but frankly, who will challenge us and set an expectation that we have to meet. And that's very important. Even though the Legislative Audit Commission is our boss, so to speak, again, one of the important things that members of the legislature have recognized over the years, from the beginning and throughout all the years, is that an auditor needs independence. And so we have to be accountable to the legislature and the Legislative Audit Commission. We have been given considerable independence to do our work. That really is another cornerstone of our credibility. Independence comes organizationally. I'm appointed by the Legislative Audit Commission for 6 years, and what the law says is that I can't be removed except for cause. We've never really had a test of what that cause might be. It's probably not issuing a report that one of you doesn't like, because I think there have been a number of reports that probably were not your favorites. I think there are a lot of reports that are. But I think you understood that to have a nonpartisan, independent office, that there had to be a term of office for the legislative auditor, and I'm serving my six-year term. Another thing that has been established over the years, and this isn't frankly in the law, but people like Senator Rest and Senator Kiffmeyer have seen the need for this, and that is that we issue our reports without any prior review by the legislature or the Legislative Audit Commission. I think sometimes people are surprised by that you don't see our reports until everybody else does. And so that gives us a level of independence and credibility, and also responsibility and even sometimes some vulnerability that we have to stand behind the reports that we give you. And that's why our first goal, our primary goal, is that every report that we give you will be accurate, objective, timely, and useful. So turning to the next slide, and I think Mr. Boozy and Ms. Randall are really going to talk through most of these. And that's our work products, our financial audits, our IT audits, our program evaluations. I will just say a word about the investigations and special reviews, because I work on those quite a bit myself. From time to time, issues come up. The Legislative Audit Commission has set a work agenda for us in our Program Evaluation Division. Our Financial Audit Division has a lot of required work that is required by law, and we have discretionary audits that Mr. Boozy is going to talk about. But sometimes an issue will come up. I will see it in the newspaper or on a television. You will, too. Issues about allegations that our child care assistance program has a significant amount of fraud and that some of the money that is obtained through fraud is used for terrorist organizations in foreign countries. That's alarming. That's very alarming. And it deserves an independent, thorough, credible review to determine whether or not those allegations are factually based. And that's what I'm working on with my colleagues at the Office of Legislative Auditor right now, and we hope to have that report for you in the next several weeks. And so that's the authority that we have and the responsibility we have to conduct investigations and special reviews. And as I've often said, we do call them special just because we hadn't planned on doing them. And sometimes they really do cover important, high-visibility topics, and they're special for that reason as well. Our organization is straightforward and simple. You might, by the way, in this little extra packet that we included, there's an organization chart. Let's see, it's on page 7. But it just shows, you know, the very simple, straightforward organization that we have, a relatively small office, reporting to the Legislative Audit Commission with the legislative auditor in our two divisions. Altogether, we have 60 professionals. Mr. Boozy and Ms. Randall are going to talk about the backgrounds and characteristics of some of those staff in our financial audit division and our program evaluation division. And then we know, too, that this is not a time for discussion of budgets, but we, too, just wanted to give you a big high-level snapshot of our current budget and how we spend that money. 92% of all of the money that we receive goes into payroll. So we are, by and large, staff in terms of our expenses. We also pay rent, which is a little bit different from some of the other legislative offices. We're in the Centennial Building, and so 4% of the money that we have in our budget goes to pay the rent, and 4% for other operating expenses. So with that, Madam Chair, if I could turn to Mr. Boozy to give us, again, a quick overview of the work in the Financial Audit Division, and then he will turn it over to Ms. Randall for an overview of the Program Evaluation Division. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles.
Just a moment.
Before they finish?
Who do you pay rent to, Madam Chair? Is it Department of Administration?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, that's correct. Okay, it's a state-owned building, and we pay rent to the Department of Administration.
All right. Mr. Boozy, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today, and I believe you're going to do the Financial Audit Division overview.
Madam Chair, committee members, first off, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to testify today. We're going to have some fairly brief remarks, but I thought it was important just to start off by talking about the distinction between the Financial Audit Division and the Program Evaluation Division. I think one of the biggest distinctions between the two is that, as the name implies, the Financial Audit Division addresses financial-related audit questions. Specifically, we look at audit work. We do audit work to make sure that state resources are used appropriately, that we're safeguarding assets. And also, as part of our work, one of the things that we typically do is look at compliance with the underlying laws for any given appropriation or area that's under review. The staff that we deploy are primarily certified public accountants and certified fraud examiners. We have people with deep financial expertise. But we also have two individuals on our staff who perform IT audit work, and they have expertise in IT. So we have a concept of required audit work, and what that really means is that about 66% of the work that we have in the division is required under state law. And on the screen and in your handouts, you can see some examples of the types of required audit work that we have. The two on the left are probably the largest audits that we do. The first is the audit of the state's financial statements, and the second is the audit of the state's federal programs. We spend significant amount of work, and we testified before the Audit Commission last week about some of the financial work that we do. A key takeaway, though, for the state's financial statements is not only do we do the work on the statements so that the state can sell bonds and it's part of the investment process, but those financial statements really provide a treasure trove of information for all policymakers. You can look at those statements and you can see the government-wide financial position of the state as a whole, but you also can look down into individual program areas as well. So if you like the environment, you can go down and see how the Game and Fish Fund is operating, or you can look at the Healthcare Access Fund. The federal program report that we audit as well, I think that's also an interesting document for policymakers to take a look at. Most people don't know that the state of Minnesota participates in over 400 federal programs, and we have about $15 billion in financial activity each year. You can go into that report and you can see the expenditures for all the programs. And when we do the audit work in that area, we not only audit the expenditures, but we also look at internal controls over those programs. And we look at key compliance features as well, such as eligibility. We have some other examples of required audit work on the list as well. But one that I wanted to point out right now is healthcare. We spend a significant amount of money on health care audits. It's required in state law. But even if it wasn't required in state law, I think that's a really good area for us to look at. And the reason why is because when you look at our federal program report each year and you look at those 400-plus programs, I can categorize those programs as small, medium, and large based on the dollars, with the large programs being those federal programs that are spending hundreds of millions, and in the case of areas like highway transportation aids, it's upper hundreds of millions of dollars each year. But there is one program on the list that overshadows them all, and that's medical assistance. As of FY17, we don't have the current numbers completed yet, but the last number was about $6.8 billion of spend, and that's on the federal side, and there's an equal state match as well. So that one program is important to audit because of its complexity and because of its size. It vastly overshadows everything else. In fact, that one program is individually significant on state government for state government as a whole. When we talk about discretionary work, this is that one-third of the financial audit division's budget that we get to pick our topics. But I think the thing that's important to point out is we don't pick the topics on our own. We seek input from policymakers. We also look at the types of complaints that are coming into our office through state government. For members that are part of the Audit Commission, you know that I send out a letter to to policymakers asking for solicitations on potential topics. And all of that goes in to our decision-making process when we pick those targets that we're going to be looking at during a year. The key thing to point out, though, is that when you circle back to our mission, accurate, objective, timely, and useful, we're trying to pick topics that are relevant to policymakers because that's what makes them useful. The example report on the screen is a report that I absolutely love. It's called Shared Business System Cost Management. And that's a case study on how we fund big government computer systems. It talks about the systems that are deployed by Minnesota Management and Budget on behalf of all agencies. And I think one thing that people may not recognize is that since the deployment of the shared business systems, we've spent about $400 million on those computer systems. And one of the things we wanted to do in that study is we wanted to say, how do we fund those systems? What kind of cost models do we have in place to manage the cost of those systems? And we had some really interesting recommendations in that report, both for the agency and for the legislature, on how we can better fund major computer systems and do long-range cost planning for IT. And then finally, I want to just chat briefly about information technology audits. We only have two members of our staff that work in that area, but that's an area that I really hope can become a growth area for OLA. As all of you know, IT is extremely complicated, and I believe that today there's a gap in information that comes over onto the legislative side that it's difficult for policymakers to understand what's going on with all these systems that are being built, all of the systems that are out there in the state's IT portfolio. We have about 3,000 to 4,000 applications in the state of Minnesota that citizens rely on, and there's also, besides MNLARS, many major applications that are being developed. The key thing is, are there appropriate controls, or do we have future disasters on the horizon as well? I think the OLA is poised to help the legislature address some of those questions, in addition to looking at some really important areas for citizens, such as cybersecurity. On the MNLARS front, we have several audits underway, that's being led up on the program evaluation side. But on the financial audit side, we are now doing quarterly audit work on some of the information that Public Safety and Minute report to the MNLARS Steering Committee. We recently completed some work where we looked at system outages and system slowdowns. The next round, which will be coming out probably in February, is going to talk about title backlogs. And one area that I think will be really, really important to policymakers is we're going to be deciphering the budget. And there's been a lot of questions about how much money is needed for the ongoing operation of the system, how much money is going to be needed for the completion of the project. But my team of IT auditors is studying the budget numbers right now, and hopefully we can put together a really good report that talks about the cost planning model that the agencies have in place for the system. And I think that'll help policymakers coming up this session as they have questions, as questions arise on how much funding is actually needed for these systems. And with that said, Madam Chair, I would like to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Ms. Judy Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Boozy. Appreciate your laying things out for us. So, Ms. Randall, you're going to do the program evaluation, and you've been before the committee before. Glad to see you. And if you want to just go forward, and just to remind us, for the record, especially the first time you speak, your name and title. All right?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. Nice to be here again and seeing you all. Real quickly, the Program Evaluation Division is the smaller of the two divisions. We have about 15 full-time staff. We are subject matter generalists, so we're not an expert in education, an expert in human services, an expert in transportation. We don't have those subject matter expertise. Instead, what we have are research experts, so folks who have master's degrees in public policy or PhDs in political science and expertise in statistics. So we can go into a subject area really pretty naive, frankly, and go in and ask kind of those dumb questions, which I think help us get to some interesting answers because we kind of take a step back and say, wait, why are we doing this in the first place? Ultimately, we produce about 5 to 7 program evaluations annually. The common thread across the evaluations is that they are programs that receive state money. Other than that, they really run the spectrum. Here are the evaluation topic titles from the evaluations we released last year. And you can see they really run the gamut from Board of Animal Health's oversight of deer and elk farms, kind of looking at some of the concerns related to chronic wasting disease. We looked at the Office of Health Facility Complaints. That's that office within the Department of Health that receives complaints related to nursing home and care for vulnerable adults. And then we also looked at voter registration. So you can see the real range of topics that we evaluated there. Just a moment, or I'll just pause for a moment to talk about how we do these evaluations. As I said, we're research experts, and so what we do is we employ every research method we can think of. So sure, we look at data and crunch numbers and look at agency data in lots of different ways, including ways for which it wasn't intended. We read the law, we read the national literature, but we also get out and talk to the people who are affected by the programs. So for example, on the evaluation of Office of Health Facility Complaints, we accompanied nursing home investigators. We went out to nursing homes and we shadowed the investigators. We talked with residents in the nursing homes and looked at the files and looked at the facilities. For an evaluation years ago on alternative learning programs, we surveyed the students who attended those programs. We went to the schools and had focus groups with those students and focus groups with the teachers and the administrators. So not only are we talking to the agency staff that run these programs, but we are also making a real point to get out and talking to the folks that receive services through the programs or that are affected by the programs. And it really helps to give us a good understanding of all the different perspectives related to the service the program is providing. And then also it gives us lots of good ideas for the recommendations. I do want to spend a little bit of time just talking about how our topics are selected. This is where we really differ, I think, from the Financial Audit Division and from our special reviews. The Program Evaluation Division conducts evaluations on topics selected by the Legislative Audit Commission. Period. We don't have discretion, unlike my colleagues up here. We can only do evaluations on the topics selected by the Legislative Audit Commission. And we have a pretty involved process, as Senator Kiffmeyer and Senator Rest know. And it's one that's really important because it involves all of you. One of the key things that we want to do is produce reports that are useful. And so we want to make sure that we are looking at topics that you care about. So the first step is that we compile a list. We just call it the master list of topics. What topics would you like us to look at? What state-funded program? Again, that's really the only criteria at that point. Would you like us to look at? I compile this list year-round. Usually right after we select topics, I start getting new topics. I receive them from you all and from staff, but I also receive them from the public. I receive them from agency staff. I've received them from commissioners asking us to look at programs within their agencies. Certainly OLA staff, when we go out and look at, when we do financial audits or other evaluations, we see things that we think maybe could stand a closer look. So anyways, we compile this list. Usually the list has between 100 and 130 different programs that people would like us to evaluate. And again, ultimately we only evaluate 5 to 7 programs a year. So the Audit Commission has a big job in front of them to narrow down that list. So the first thing they do is they look at that master list and they narrow it down to usually around 15 topics. So it's kind of a workable list. That's really the hardest place where the cuts happen. Then what we do with those 15 topics is staff develop kind of some background information. How long has the program been around? Are there data available that we could use? Have there been big changes recently that would make it a good or bad time for us to look at it? At the same time, though, we are surveying all of you to gauge your interest in the topics. And really, as I've watched the Audit Commission make its decisions over the year, I think the single most important thing is your survey responses. Where do legislators want us to spend our time? So then ultimately the Audit Commission meets again, looks at the survey responses, looks at the feedback from staff, and ultimately selects the final topics for evaluation. When the Audit Commission is looking at the topics, though, they do consider these criteria in particular. I just want to talk about them just briefly. The first is state control and resources. So first of all, how much state money is involved? And does the state control the program? If it's a federal program, then having us look at it and make recommendations for improvement isn't really going to make much of a difference because you all won't be able to make big changes. But if it's a state program, you can. So that's really one of the first things the Audit Commission looks at. The other issue, or other topic is, sorry, the other criteria is impact. How many people does this program affect, and how deeply does it affect them? So, for example, we did an evaluation last year on early childhood programs. That affects a lot of people across the whole state. Big impact, right? A lot of people. I would say the Office of Health Facility Complaints doesn't affect as many people, but it affects them really deeply. We're talking about the care vulnerable adults receive. So again, big impact in a different way, kind of a deeper impact on maybe a smaller number of people. So again, the Audit Commission considers these different perspectives on impact. Timeliness is another one that's really important. Did we just do an evaluation on this program last year? Well, maybe we should give them a chance to make some improvements before we evaluate them again. Or is it a brand new program? Or did they just make big changes? So those are the things that we will suggest to the Audit Commission. Maybe it's a good time or not so good of a time to conduct an evaluation. Feasibility, is it something we can do, quite simply? Are the data available, and is it kind of within our wheelhouse? And then finally, balance. The Audit Commission wants to pick a balanced slate. They don't want us to do 5 evaluations all related to education. Frankly, we're kind of a burden on an agency when we conduct an evaluation. We go and ask for a lot of information. We take up people's time. So we try to kind of spread the love, if you will, across the different state agencies so they're not hearing from all 15 of us all in 1 year. So those are the main criteria that the Audit Commission considers. I don't know if Senator Kiffmeyer or Senator Rest want to weigh in more on that. But with that, I think that ends the planned comments that we have. And, of course, we'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Randall. And you've always been accessible and very helpful during the topic selection process. It does engage all of us. And that isn't always very easy process to go through. But I know that we've always appreciated your assistance and your help. So at this time, I have one questioner. Senator Rest?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I did have a hallway conversation with Ms. Randall about the statute that requires a general program that is a funding program of one sort or another that they are required to undertake, and that has become a little bit unwieldy, and that unfortunately it can't be changed simply by the action of the Legislative Audit Commission. It has to, and I'm hoping Ms. Randall, Mr. Nobles, Mr. Boozy, you all are working on language that you can submit to the Legislative Audit Commission at some near time as to what would be an improvement in that statute that would make your reports more meaningful to the legislature. And I thank you for bringing that up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Ms. Randall, did you have any other comment on that subject?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, just to explain for those who aren't as familiar with our responsibilities, couple of years ago, I think 2015 legislature, put into our law a requirement that one of our program evaluations each year be related to an economic development incentive program. So we didn't receive more program evaluation staff, but simply one of the slots for a program evaluation topic was now taken up by an economic development incentive program. And I think there was a lot of interest in making sure that we're looking at those programs, and I think that's a good thing. But maybe those aren't always the best program to look at in a given year. And so the law kind of hamstrung, I think, the Audit Commission into requiring them to select one of those topics. And one of the things that we were discussing is rather than requiring us to do an evaluation of a certain topic, maybe we make sure that it's added as one of these topic selection criteria, that we really consider the economic development impact of a program program as we're selecting topics. I think the concern is that there are 201 legislators all have different interests. And if we start saying, well, one of the evaluations has to be related to economic development and one has to be related to education and one has to, we start to kind of hem in, I think, the freedom of the Audit Commission to select the topics that in that year they think are the most important. So I think we had a casual conversation with Senator Rest about perhaps looking at ways to meet both the needs of the Audit Commission and also give them a little more flexibility.
And thank you, Ms. Randall. Mr. Nobles.
I would just add that we are working on what we call a housekeeping bill, which I think will be uncontroversial, and we will be presenting that to the Legislative Audit Commission as soon as a new commission is formed. And that is one of the issues we want to address. There are a few others. I might just say, our law, you have it in your packet, is very important to us. It really defines who we are, what we do, and what we don't do. And so we do, from time to time, look at the law, see where it needs to have some modification, additions, subtractions. So we will be having a housekeeping bill that we will bring forth to the Legislative Audit Commission and seek members to introduce that later in the session, but relatively soon.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Nobles. I appreciate that update on that subject as well. Just to mention, the topics filter down, though, but they really do come from a broad cross-section of state government and the general public. And the legislators themselves, all of us, have the opportunity to vote to narrow that list down. But, as we go through that process, it is a very much direct involvement of all legislators. So we look forward to seeing that language when you have it ready, Mr. Nobles. With that, we have Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is also sort of about the topic selection, but more on the discretionary side. So, Ms. Randall, less relevant to you, but I do think it's still sort of a theme that might be consistent. Some of the comments that were made in the aspects of selecting topics, whether it's because of news stories or because of complaints, it made me start thinking, and I'm an old researcher, so, random selection matters in how we get to things to make sure we're not skewing the perspective. It's not so much that there's a question or a problem about the topics that are being selected, but are topics not being found because of if it bleeds, it leads kind of stuff. The squeaky wheel may not necessarily be the wheel that actually needs the most attention. And I'm wondering if any of you would care to address how you do that, and if we could do that better.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Probably one of the things when you talk about the squeaky wheel, there are those, and the legislative auditor has that opportunity. But also I was struck by how much of your work is almost so regular, and financial audits especially are required by statute and other things. So sometimes we don't hear about them as much. But there's an awful lot that goes on that is of that kind of work, not necessarily the squeaky. But Mr. Nobles, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Kent, I think it's a very important question. I would just echo that I think we are typically known by the general public when we do one of the squeaky wheels. And we feel that that's important to do because if the public's confidence is shaken by something they hear in the news, I think they sit at home and say, well, who is there to look into that? And it's our responsibility to do that. But I agree with you that we can't always just be chasing after what is on the nightly news. We have to have a regular schedule of audits and evaluations that are just the operations of state government that need ongoing oversight. And so that's why I think Mr. Boozy emphasized that's the foundation, and then the work of the Legislative Audit Commission. But I think you make a good point about what is not getting a good look. And we actually have those conversations. I know when Mr. Boozy came into our office, back into our office, you know, he was very good at saying, you know, there's some things out there that probably aren't getting headlines because, you know, maybe there aren't problems, but we ought to go and see. MnPass, for example, we took a look just because it hadn't been looked at. And it's an important program, and we found it's going fine, you know. And so, but it needed a look. It needed an outside examination. And so we go through that discussion. What is the public concerned about that's on the nightly news? What are you concerned about because what's on the nightly news? But also, what is there that's kind of in back maybe a little bit further that we need to look at periodically just because they need accountability too?
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Boozy, just briefly, so sure. We have another three people have questions.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Kent, we have a big list of potential discretionary audit targets that came in from policymakers. We also bring in some of the financial-related items that come through the Program Evaluation Subcommittee. And when we have to narrow it down based on the resources at our disposal, it's really painful to see how many really, really important areas of government are on that list that we just don't have the resource to get to. So I feel your pain more than you feel the pain on that particular one. But the area that concerns me the most is that when you look at how important technology is in our government and the resources that are on the table right now, the vast majority of these critical IT systems across state government never get examined by an independent person ever. And I think that's one of the things that makes me cringe the most. We have one on the docket coming up this year that I shared in advance notice with Senator Kiffmeyer and Senator Rest on the Audit Commission, but that's one of the areas that I worry about the most.
Thank you, Mr. Boozy. Well said. I would agree with that. Senator Newman, and then after that is Senator Curran and Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boozy, you had talked briefly about the report coming out on the budget for MNLARS, and I'm particularly interested in and worried about the budget involving MNLARS, as I anticipate we're not only going to get a budget request from two state agencies, but we're going to have multiple requests for funding coming from different organizations, and they're all going to come at the same time. So my question to you is the MNLARS budget report that you made reference to, is that going to be out in time for us to make use of it during this budget year?
Mr. Nobles, do you want to try that, or do you want to have Mr. Boozy?
Madam Chair, I think I'll have Mr. Boozy answer that. The answer is yes, but I want him to say that.
Okay, Mr. Boozy.
Madam Chair, committee members, the answer is yes, and I'll preface that by saying that really what we are trying to get at with that report is that very much like the work we did on our shared business system cost management, we operate under the assumption that an agency should have a long-term funding model or long-term cost plan for a system. It's a computer system. It's hardware, it's software, it's people, there's known upgrades. I should be able to ask them and say, I want to see the 10-year cost plan for the system. And I should be able to take my IT audit team knowing what needs to happen with the computer system and break that down into contracts and people and modules, not only for the long-term operation of the system, but for that project to get the rest of the system completed. So we're planning to deliver the results of that work probably in February, and the timing of that is designed so that when the conversations come to bear about budget requests and other things. We wanted to give the legislature some independent assessment of, is there a cost model, and if so, do we agree with it?
Thank you, Mr. Boozy. Senator Uman, thank you for that question. Senator Curran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment for Mr. Boozy and a question for Ms. Randall. Mr. Boozy, and it relates to MNLARS, and used the term backlog. We would prefer you keep that term in your reports and your dialogue and don't allow the agency to rephrase that or retitle it to work in progress. That was a statement on one of the last hearings, so we want to continue to follow and set service level agreements that we adhere to. That's just a comment. Thank you. And Ms. Randall, you talked about in the selection of the audits and feasibility. One of them was if we had the skill sets. Mm-hmm. And so have we had, or what do we do if we determine a need and we don't have the skill set? What's the process we go through, and do we reach out and acquire external resources?
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Curran. Yes, we have engaged contractors, private consultants, maybe actuaries. Sometimes I recall an evaluation years ago when it was on a technical program related to energy, and we needed some expertise there. We did an evaluation on deer population management, and so we needed to engage with a consultant who specialized in animal populations. I know there's a better term for it than that, but that's what's coming to mind now. So we certainly can reach out and have done that in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who this question is to, but my question is when you go out and do an audit or a review of a evaluation, what happens when you uncover actually illegal activity? Is there a process, or could you explain the current process of what happens to that?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nobles.
Senator Howe, and congratulations being in the upper body. We do uncover illegal acts, or ones that we think are illegal acts, namely the misuse of public resources. We are not a criminal investigative organization, but as we conduct investigations and even audits, we will from time to time come across evidence that we think needs to be considered by law enforcement. And so we will refer that to them. We have on many occasions, frankly, worked with county attorneys, with the U.S. attorney, with the FBI, and with others. We certainly do not want to get in their way. And so with when we start to see something that looks like a crime, we will contact the appropriate jurisdiction. And sometimes it's federal authorities, sometimes it's local authorities. And sometimes they will say, move out of the way, let us take this over, we move out of the way. But sometimes, actually, they want us to stay with that assignment and finish it and then turn over that evidence, and then they will take it from there. So often it does result in prosecutions of people for misusing state resources. So we do. It's actually a requirement in the law that we do that, and so we build those relationships over time. Also, we work with the Attorney General's Office on civil recoveries.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Okay, members, with that, we've concluded our business for the day, and I will appreciate seeing you again this week, but for today, we are adjourned.